From the Center for Western Priorities, this is Go West Young Podcast, coming to you this week from the Society of Environmental Journalists Conference. We are in Fort Collins, Colorado, as you can probably hear, inside the Grand Ballroom at Colorado State University. This conference, SEJ, is really something. You got several hundred environmental reporters, photographers, editors, storytellers getting together for 5 days to compare notes, listen to some really amazing all-star panel discussions, and explore their host city. This being Colorado in October, we got temperatures in the teens and an early snowstorm for the field trips that happened on Thursday. And then on Friday, William Perry Pendley took the stage here. Pendley was part of a panel discussion called Public Lands at the Crossroads. It was moderated by Juliet Eilperin of The Washington Post. We have talked about Pendley a whole lot on this podcast over the last couple months. He is the longtime public lands opponent who is now the acting head of the Bureau of Land Management. And our guest today was also part of that conversation on stage. He went head-to-head with Pendley in a couple moments. John Freemuth is the executive director of the Cecil Andrus Center for Public Policy at Boise State University. In addition to his lengthy academic credentials, Professor Freemuth was also the chair of the Bureau of Land Management's Science Advisory Board back during the Clinton administration. He has also been a high school teacher, a park ranger, even an IRS revenue officer, and he got his PhD right here at Colorado State. So John Freemuth, Professor Freemuth, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
So let's start with this morning's discussion and how the Bureau of Land Management is in the midst of dismantling the agency's D.C. headquarters. They're taking a few hundred employees out into field offices and establishing an ostensible new headquarters in Grand Junction, Colorado, but with only 27 people in an office that will be just down the hall from Chevron and a bunch of other oil and gas companies. You've made the case that this move will hamstring BLM. Why is that?
Yeah, I've said that, and of course I was honored to also say this on the Hill when Chairman Grijalva held a hearing that was mainly about Mr. Pendley, but I was on a panel with some other folks. The fact of the matter is, on one side of the equation, BLM is already a very decentralized agency, really governed by state directors, not regional directors, but there are national questions. These are national lands. And there will be decisions where BLM needs to interact with other agencies and various specialists and go up and down the hall and have conversations. If they're in Grand Junction and there's that kind of a question, they're not going to be in the conversation. The cliche is, if you're at a dinner party and you're not invited, you're on the menu. That's the problem.
Or to borrow from Hamilton, you have to be in the room where it happens.
Yep.
So give us an example of the kinds of decisions that BLM would need to be in the room for.
Well, for example, you brought up Colorado State, where I wrote my dissertation here, and then it was turned into a book about external threats to national parks caused from activities outside, many of which are legal but create conflict. Well, one of the things I study is central Utah has tar sands, and they underlie Glen Canyon, where I was a ranger, Canyonlands National Park, and a lot of BLM land. And BLM and the Park Service had to prepare a joint EIS and had to work with each other on that particular agency, because many people don't know that that unit of the park system, Glen Canyon, has authorized mineral leasing by Congress. So if the director's in Grand Junction and he needs to work, or she needs to work with their counterpart in the Park Service, in Maine Interior, they can go talk to each other.
Walk down the hall,
bring their people with them.
Yeah,
now you've got, you know, how does that benefit anybody when issues like that are separated geographically by 2,000, 3,000 miles sometimes?
Do you think the end result of this would just be that folks like Bernhardt and his top group of political appointees end up making these decisions?
Yeah, they'll still be in D.C. I mean, it's not who the decision maker is, it's where they are. And in that particular case, they need to be in Washington. In other cases, the state directors are empowered to make these decisions for the agency, not Washington. But there are some issues that are simply transcend states.
and get up to that
that
top cabinet level.
Yes.
You've obviously, I presume, have contacts throughout BLM rank and file, and probably at Park Service.
Former students,
as well.
Too. Yeah.
So what are you hearing? How is morale right now in the middle of all this?
My impression is it's not well. I think you and other folks reported that right before the time we held the hearing, there was a BLM meeting with internal people and Mr. Penley, and it was fairly angry. I mean, you have people whose careers have been spent in the West and in Washington. Now they're in Washington with families, spouses who work, whole networks of relationships, and you're going to uproot them like that with just no say? They have another point. They've not had a director for 3 years.
No one's ever been nominated.
No one's been nominated, nor has the Park Service, nor has Fish and Wildlife. Unprecedented.
And Pendley, despite the fact that he lives or lived in Evergreen, Colorado, is not planning to go to Grand Junction as part of this, as far as
because he will be in a different position. That will be someone who's in charge of policy, but not director of the agency.
Okay. So also during this session today, when they opened it up to questions from journalists in the audience, Pendley was asked about why BLM rank and file staff aren't allowed to give interviews, why Interior is stonewalling public records requests. I want to just play a little bit of tape here. This is Tim Wheeler, who's the head of the Freedom of Information Task Force, that's part of the Society of Environmental Journalists. Take a listen here.
Reporters are telling me that they're having difficulty, that they cannot get interviews with staff, and that they can't get questions answered in a timely fashion. They can't get interviews, certainly without going through PIOs. And the PIOs are telling me that they can't grant interviews or answer questions from national media or on controversial topics without those getting approved by political appointees or their designates. Yours is not the first administration to practice this kind of censorship by PIO, but it certainly has carried it to a further extreme. My question to you is, do you have a written policy or guideline or regulation that limits or restricts employees from speaking to the press? And if so, is there discipline if they do so? And if you can't answer that question, will you bring it back to the headquarters and get us answers to that? And if there is that kind of a policy, what's the justification for it?
There is no such policy. I'm not going to grant your assertions. I spent an hour last night with a reporter from Bloomberg News. I spent an hour this morning with Juliet. I've got an afternoon full of interviews from reporters. I answer questions every day from the media that come in via email. We are responding as quickly as possible to all the FOIA requests. Our solicitor at the department testified before the House Natural Resources Committee, and I think he fully answered all the questions that were asserted in the vein of yours, that we're not being responsive, we're not complying with the law, and we're interfering politically with regard to obligations under the Freedom of Information Act. So, sir, I just disagree.
Well, if I may, just one quick follow-up.
All right, very quickly.
You're a political appointee. I'm talking about the thousands of employees out there who are actually carrying out the work on the ground, and they are not allowed to speak to the press.
Tries to ask the same question again. He still doesn't answer. Yeah.
Okay, great. Professor Freeman wants
to. Real quick, this is not just a BLM issue, it's an Interior issue. I know for a fact that Park Service superintendents concerned with certain issues, perhaps with BLM and a development too close to the boundaries, are now not allowed to do comments. That has to go up to Washington to be looked at. So this may be more a department-wide issue than something particular to one agency.
Juliet, yeah. Nonsense. Absolute nonsense. We have on our website and the BLM website, regarding our move, we have an FAQ up for all our employees. So they can send us a question about the move so we can answer their questions. One of the questions was, do I still have the ability to contact my senator or congressman to give him my views on the move? And our answer was, we will not interfere with your constitutional rights to exercise your First Amendment rights of speech or to seek redress of grievances. And that's absolutely our position. So if employees want to talk to the media, hey, I got a send button on my computer, and every time I hit send, it ends up at E&E. And I don't know how that happens. But apparently our employees are not constrained with regard to communicating with y'all.
All right. So Pendley called your assertion there nonsense, that this is a department-wide issue, but he then went on to answer a completely different question that was not asked of him, implying that somehow his employees aren't allowed to contact members of Congress. The question was, are they allowed to just talk to reporters if a reporter has a question about what they're doing as part of their job?
Right.
And it's your understanding, I'm going to assume the understanding of just about every reporter in this room, that is the order. They're not allowed to just pick up the phone and call a reporter back. Is that what's going
on? Well, yeah, and what I was really trying to get at is that if you take a local issue where a park superintendent has concerns about let's call it a BLM external threat, in the past they are allowed to put publicly in comment documents, and thus reporters like yourself would see this, their concerns. Now that has to all be reviewed by Washington. And so there's sort of been a suppression of their official duties, as it were, to express their concerns. We all know that could get overruled in Washington, but now we don't even know what a local official might be thinking. And the other point is, of course they have First Amendment rights as citizens. The question is, as a duly representative person of the agency,
Doing your job,
You ought to be able to enlighten a reporter about concerns with the understanding that these decisions, of course, are reviewed at other levels.
And I mean, just an example of what a BLM external threat would be. This would be where they were proposing oil and gas leases right on the doorstep of Great Sand Dunes National
Park.
Yes,
which has happened in the past. Yeah. That's you know, let's be fair to people. To some people, oil and gas is very important. To me, it's a legitimate use of BLM lands. But if it's going to impact a resource next to them of a cherished protected area, then the two agencies ought to have a conversation, and the Park Service person ought not to have their comments as a superintendent of that area reviewed.
Subject to political review.
Right. They could take it higher and decide we're going to do something else. But that's a different story.
So transparency writ large sounds like has changed under Pendley and Bernhardt from your previous time with the administration. How much political control or review was there, and how much more is being exercised now than we'd seen under either Democrats or Republicans before?
Well, there's always been oversight in Washington. I mean, there are political appointees there, and there's a reason for that. And Democratic appointees have done the same thing. Let's be fair here. But this seems to be further than we've ever seen before. Nobody ever proposed, for example, moving the BLM to the West. Kind of thing. And there seems to be, at least, again, I'm talking informally, a chilling of morale and a fear that I just need to keep my mouth quiet here more than ever before. I mean, most feds that I know in management have always been circumspect about their understanding of their role.
There was also a question today about Interior rushing through environmental reviews. And Pendley basically doubled down on it. The quote was, NEPA is where projects go to die, NEPA being the National Environmental Policy Act. It's one of America's bedrock conservation laws. The conversation moved on quickly before anyone had a chance to respond to that, so I'll just give it to you. Is NEPA where projects go to die?
Well, what's happened is, of course, because of the need to write a comprehensive document that withstands legal review, they've gotten longer and longer. There's no question. And the real issue, and here's where I don't disagree with, and this came before Pendley, if you could make those documents more readable than sometimes they are, they're jargon filled, and the average citizen kind of throws their hands up.
A lack of accessibility.
Wait a
minute.
A
legitimate concern.
That's legitimate, but the idea of if you don't do comprehensive analysis, I mean, how you write it is important. It ought to be clear. You're going to get sued. You're going to miss something. And so that's what makes these things long and slow.
And so when Pendley uses his example of getting a 3,000-page NEPA analysis down to 300, you think that actually, does that put the analysis then at future legal risk because they haven't done the work.
I would think it would, knowing the environmental litigators as I do, and sometimes I would certainly agree with them and sometimes I wouldn't. It's like the other side. They're going to look for all kinds of things, and at 3,000 pages could probably be made shorter and more readable, but cut by 90%, given the scrutiny that goes on in analysis, yeah, you're going to go get sued. I would put, you know, that's already coming up with the Park Service now and something else.
So your research is focused on the relationship between science and policy decisions, primarily on public lands. How did that relationship work when you were chair of the BLM's Science Advisory Board under Secretary Babbitt, and what, how does it seem to be working now?
Well, number one, we were abolished as the second Bush administration came in, and you know we follow orders, as Mr. Pendley would say, we're gone. But we provided a useful role to BLM in helping them think through their science priorities, and then we helped write the science strategy where BLM could have a clear process identifying its top science need. Then it gets go to its partners like the USGS, which does damn fine science.
Right.
And so the abolishment of that and just generally the chilling of science generally we've all read about, the advisory committees in EPA, the RACs, which are not necessarily science-based, but
are
local.
Let me just back up. That's resource advisory councils, local advisory councils.
For BLM, those are not being filled. They're being reduced. They provide local input that's huge at the local level. But just, one way you avoid a controversial decision is suppress the knowledge you need to make a good decision.
I want to flag down my colleague Jesse Prentice Dunn, who you've heard here on the podcast before, because we're talking about RACs, and Jesse just did an analysis on the Resource Advisory Councils. Just give us the rundown on what happened there.
Sure. So of the 37 Resource Advisory Councils around the West, the Trump administration first suspended all of them. And then subsequently, they've renewed the charters for 30 of those 37, including politically charged language around energy dominance and reducing regulations. And so the key finding here is that of these 30 kind of politically driven RAC charters, 17 of them have not met yet. And so even though they're kind of reinstating them, by and large, these committees have been sidelined.
And the new charters have like explicit energy dominance language in them, and that's also new.
It's really wide-ranging. It says that the committees or councils shall make recommendations about increasing exploration and development of federal energy resources and shall make recommendations about regulations that are burdensome to be repealed.
So, in other words, they're looking does it sound to you, Professor, that they're looking for a rubber stamp?
Well, yeah, I mean, the RACs are supposed to advise BLM on all sorts of issues, and they're supposed to be fairly diverse. This is what Secretary Babbitt did. These used to be essentially grazing advisory committees, which was fine back in the day, but our values have gotten a lot more diverse. So they shouldn't have that as their top priority. Of course, it's one of theirs, and then it's who gets on these committees becomes the next important question and needs to be scrutinized by folks.
If they can get people to sign up, appears to be part of the problem right now.
If they can, yes.
Let's back up, because you are the head of the Cecil Andrus Center at Boise State. Who was Cecil Andrus, and what does the Andrus Center do?
Two things. I'm now the Cecil Andrus Endowed Chair of Public Lands. We have an executive director, Katie Robb, who's here, holding down the Boise State and Boise page for next year, and she's better at that than I am. Cecil Andrus was four-term governor of Idaho, Secretary of Interior in the Carter administration, who both had to help implement FLIPMA, the BLM's Organic Act, worked with President Carter and these giants of Congress then to protect Alaska.
I think it's important to look back at that moment in history, what happened during the Carter administration. Those are the bedrock laws that still govern public lands policy today. At that time, you're coming in after things like the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act that Nixon had signed, but now there was a realization that you had. Well, so first of all, President Carter exercised his authority under the Antiquities Act in some never-before-seen ways, particularly in Alaska.
Yes,
and that led to the passage of ANILCA. And then you had Congress coming together to pass FLIPMA. Why was that so important at the time? And has, in your opinion, has the vision of FLIPMA from 40 years ago, has that paid off correctly? Or do you think these laws are in need of some fine-tuning?
Well, okay, number one, it made it clear to everybody at all times that the BLM lands, most of them, were national lands, and would be. It clarified that they would remain under the administration of the United States. So that was important. Now, the NICLA Act actually came a little later, but BLM is a multiple-use agency, like the Forest Service. They must balance many uses on these lands. That's pretty important. Right now, it seems to be about every use is subordinate to energy. That would enrage folks on the side pushing this if we had a different administration saying the number one priority of the BLM lands is wilderness protection or biodiversity protection. It's a complicated mission.
With the brain drain that we are seeing right now, if there is any potential upside, it may be that in some number of years down the road, when you have another administration come in, if they then choose to take a new approach to these agencies and to land management writ large, someone came to you from Congress, a Chairman Grijalva or someone like that. What would you say? Here's how BLM could work with more guidance from Congress and administration willing to actually steward the agency into the future.
Well, it always helps. And my fellow panelists from, I believe, the energy sector said it well. Congress, when it acts well, provides the key guidance that really trumps the presidential administration of whatever party. I think what you're really getting at here is, should a member of another party, a Democrat, get elected president, or perhaps even a different Republican?
Or a different Republican. I mean, I'm not going to take your pick of any number of scenarios right now politically.
What's to stop them and their advisors and appointees from thinking, you know, really, BLM key people really need to be in Washington, and back they go? That kind of whipsawing is really hard on people. Any of your listeners, if they were in a position where suddenly they're being told to move across the country with no say and no heads up, that's a stress on people and their families.
Julia Alperin closed today's panel by asking each of you what you think the greatest threat is facing public lands today. What was your take?
My take, I used a quote from C. Sandras, where he more or less said, we're going to disagree, but these scorched earth policies and the rhetoric, and he'd actually referred to something Mr. Pendley had said in Cease's book. And what Pendley said is actually kind of funny, if we can only take a step back about cappuccino cowboys and all this. But Cease's point was, we have to learn to agree civilly with each other and not have, we're in charge now, we're just going to destroy everything you tried to do. And then, now we're back in charge and we're going to destroy everything you tried. What kind of politics is that?
There's no consistency.
No, and it whipsaws the agencies and the public hates that.
So Pendley's answer to that same question was a bit of a head-scratcher. He said the biggest threat facing public lands today are wild horses and burros. Now, obviously, there are concerns, but the greatest threat?
Yeah, that's not, I mean, that's an issue. It's important. We've been unable to solve it because of one key law and interest groups kind of polarized. We're actually seeing movement on that issue.
A little bit right now.
It's going to take some time. I would not say that's the number one threat to public lands. I heard climate a lot. I went in a different direction to talk about more democracy. But yeah, that was an odd answer.
You spent time as a seasonal park ranger at Glen Canyon. How does that time in your past inform your work now as an academic and as a researcher?
Well, like I said, I was wearing a t-shirt that people couldn't see because it was cold, but it says public lands owner. And it taught me as a ranger that these are everybody's public lands. And we need to be attentive to, where I was, the various visitors who came with marvelous questions and experiences. And you kind of felt proud to wear that uniform, you know? And I worry about the people today that they still hold those values, but they're so under siege from this rhetoric that just beats them down sometimes.
So it's the challenge of addressing morale with where
things
are right now.
It's huge. I mean, you can't have a good organization if it doesn't have good morale.
Who are some of your favorite writers when it comes to the outdoors and the West? Who do you look to for inspiration?
I have always liked to have students not only read public policy, because some of that stuff's incomprehensible nonsense unless it's written more popularly, but certainly I read Wallace Stegner. Rod Nash was a great help to me, even though he was never my professor in my dissertation. Ed Abbey, who I actually saw when I docked the boat at Lee's Ferry after patrolling up to the dam and waved, and I didn't want to bug him because he was with his daughter. Terry Tempest Williams, these Native American voices, poetry by Richard Shelton. That helps people understand the passion behind all of this.
So speaking of Native American voices, we wrap up the podcast with a look back at this week in Western history, and tribal issues did come up quite often this morning. One of the other panelists was Dina Gilio Whitaker, who's a lecturer in American Indian Studies at Cal State San Marcos. She pointed out that the entire basis of public lands law is rooted in a notion of religious supremacy over indigenous beliefs. That is the legal doctrine here. And there, as I started looking, a perfect example of that from right here in Colorado this week in 1865. And that was the Little Arkansas Treaty, signed between the U.S. and six Plains tribal nations along the Little Arkansas River right as the Civil War was ending. And those treaties gave the tribes large reservations south of the Arkansas River, promises for unrestricted hunting. And this treaty is especially notable because literally nothing in it was honored by the U.S., none at all. And 2 years later, the U.S. forced the Plains Indians back for another treaty called the Medicine Lodge Treaty, and that reduced those reservations by 90%. From your perspective, what would indigenous justice on public lands, on U.S. lands, look like now in 2019, 150, 175 years after these treaties were signed and ignored?
Certainly a way to give our diverse tribes more voice in these decisions. One of the things that I've always found fascinating in a bad way is the inability of many environmentalists to confront their hypocrisy with Native Americans. In other words, we need to admire them, but please don't give them too much power because these are our public lands. And I mean, it's just this kind of lack of understanding that how that's perceived by the tribes, I think, that there's a bit of hypocrisy there. Now, I can't speak for everybody. There are people who don't act that way. But they would have more voice, and indeed this attempt at the bear's ears to help them actually be involved in management. These are cultural resources to at least six tribes, I think.
Yes.
I would like to see something like that, but then I would also shut up and let the tribe speak to the answer to that question,
too. Of course.
Yeah.
So next year, this conference is going to be on your home turf,
yep.
quite literally the Smurf turf.
Smurf turf.
At Boise State.
Boise State.
What questions have you heard asked so far here at this conference this year that you'd like to see some answers to or some reporters dig into by the time we're in Boise next year?
Well, we've got things. We're on the other side of this Rocky Mountain Range, and we're in a desert partly. As a preface, a lot of people have said, I've never been to Boise. I've always wanted to go, so we're coming. But we've got sage grouse. Mm. We've got the National Fire Center there. We have our the salmon issue and dams up there, and the cultural treasure to our tribes, like the Nez Perce. Mm-hmm. We've got that. We've got our growth issues in Greater Boise that we are not handling too well. We could look to Fort Collins as an example in some areas. Things like that, just against wolves is another one. We've got some great issues to get, and nuclear power. We have the national lab that leads nuclear research. Whether one's pro or against it, we got the people who are dealing with that and dealing with a waste issue, INL. So we've got all kinds of issues.
I'm very much looking forward to that. I think it's great. Two Western conferences in a row, just a few hundred miles apart, but some very,
very
different Western issues to explore.
West is big.
Yeah, the West is big and not monolithic.
No.
All right, that is it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. Our guest, John Freemuth, is the executive director, endowed chair of the Cecil Andrus Center for Public Policy at Boise State University. Thank you so much, Professor, for taking the time out of this busy conference to talk to us.
Thank you. It was great.
If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or share it with a friend. We do love getting email, of course. podcast@westernpriorities.org is where to send your gripes and praise and your ideas for future episodes. Thanks to the entire CWP team. Everyone is up here at SEJ. That's the advantage of it being close to our home base. My name is Aaron Weiss. We will be back in a week or so. Thanks so much for listening.